the most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
Number two of Sports Talk begins with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. Our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch, his appearance brought to you by our good friends at New Balance Knoxville. And Doc joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates hotline. Doc, obviously there are all kinds of things being considered, just alternate thinking, sometimes out of the box. And there is a school of thought, and perhaps it could be 100% true, that once folks have had the coronavirus, that they are not susceptible to having it again. But what did you think when it was a Red Bull Motorsports advisor that at least floated the idea for Formula One, why don't we have a coronavirus camp to where all the drivers could then get infected, and then once they've come through it, since they were all in great shape, that once they all came through on the other side, they would be sick sooner rather than later?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but I think he may be drinking more than Red Bull. You know, I think that his energy source is coming from a little bit different kind of brew. You know, I'm not sure. First of all, you can't get Formula One people to agree, three people to agree on anything, and I would imagine you're not going to get them to put their $15, $18, $20 million a year drivers into a camp and say, okay, let's all get this. Well, the other thing is we don't know the backs. We don't know if that's definitive. Now, probably it is true because we're seeing the few strains that are out there. We're not seeing as much, at least right now, from what I've seen last night and today. We're not seeing as much mutation as people thought we might see with other viruses. The virus that was in Washington, the coronavirus, the COVID-19 that's in Washington, is more like the strain that came from China. The one we've seen in New York is more like the one that came from Europe. There's a bit of a discrepancy in the DNA, but not a tremendous change. So that's the good news, that we're not seeing that much mutation, which means that probably if you do get it, or you have had it, you may develop some immunity, some antibodies. And remember now, John, here's the other thing, is that there are people who can test positive. Not everybody gets tested. I mean, can be a carrier. Mm-hmm. You may be positive for the virus and not have any symptoms.
Right.
And you simply are a carrier, and you go and you can infect someone else. In fact, they said today in a small village in Italy, where it was first determined people were being diagnosed with coronavirus and COVID-19, that they decided to go in and test everyone and did it basically to see if it would work. And they tested everyone in that little small village and determined who the carriers were. They quarantined the carriers and those that had been infected. And suddenly they abruptly stopped the spread. They said, wow, I mean, boom, it was done. It stopped. They said, why couldn't you do that globally? Well, you don't have testing available, but there, you know, someone said, well, what if the U.S. today, there was a physician who said, we came out with a small packet in the U.S., much like a pregnancy test, where you could swab your nose and put it in that packet and immediately have a yes, no, you're a carrier kind of thing. You could probably, abruptly or at least significantly stop the chances of spread, risks and spread. But going back to your question, that's a school of thought. If you have it or you're exposed to it, then you're probably okay. Because if people are talking about, well, what happens if this recycles next year, as most flus and viruses do? Well, hopefully, if it does, by that time we'll have a lot more people who have been exposed and have some immunity, and maybe we'll have some semblance of they're talking about 12 to 18 months for a vaccine of some sort. Maybe we'll be there. So, you know, who knows? But I'm not sure you'd get the Formula One guys to agree to put them all in one camp and have a coronavirus camp. Although that's probably good thinking on some guy who was probably sampling Red Bull and something else.
Doc, as you mentioned at the start, you've got a pretty good feel for the circuit. Obviously, the proposal was not very well received. Now, we also saw a second virtual race, and it was Timmy Hill giving William Byron a late bump with three laps to get the win in overtime as they ran at Texas in the cloud. But Timmy Hill, it's an interesting story, very familiar with the e-racing, iRacing, but he also qualified for his first Daytona 500 this year.
Yeah, it's a nice young man, nice young kid, doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of support financially, but has proven that, in terms of online racing, and he has quite the skill. And that speaks to the point, as we saw with Sage Karam, who won the IndyCar iRace at Watkins Glen. Here are guys that if you put them on equal footing, equal ground with others in terms of equipment, could they race equally with the Jimmy Johnsons or the Kyle Busches or the other guys in IndyCar racing? And Timmy Hill, did a heck of a job winning at Texas Motor Speedway. Granted, he did it from his living room. Actually, it was from his garage, I think, where his setup was. And here's the difference is that, the iRacing, people who may not know, iRacing is computerized racing. It was developed. The software is actually owned by a guy by the name of John Henry, who also owns the Boston Red Sox. He owns all the software for iRacing. So whether it's IndyCar iRacing, NASCAR iRacing, World of Outlaws, that's his development. He developed that whole system. Now, so that's all common. What's different is the unit you sit and drive. You can go to a big box store and buy your own little in-house, toggle switches and steering wheel for a couple of $100. You could race that way. Or those simulators you can buy to race for IndyCar or NASCAR can go up to about $100,000. There are simulators that they use for iRacing to train Formula One drivers that someone told me that some of those things can cost close to $2 million for a simulator. Now, I don't think any of the guys we're watching on these races do that. I think Denny Hamlin said the unit he was sitting in his garage or his basement was about $40,000. But you can get on it and race if you want to for a couple hundred bucks. And it's a great way to fill the void. And here again, how about the vision of John Henry, who Roush Fenway, that's he's part of that team with Jack Roush for the NASCAR team and him developing the iRacing format with software.
Let's get a call from Lynn, who joins us. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Lynn.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Hope everybody's doing well and staying safe.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Hey, doing fine. Doc, got a hypothetical question for you. I'm going to make the assumption that we'll be back to organized sports by middle to late summer. That fans will be in the stands and all. So let's assume that that's true. I would assume that NASCAR will still want to run with a 16-team playoff format. But how many races do you think they will think they have to run to get to 16? Do you see a scenario where we just wouldn't have a championship run this year?
I at this point in time, Lynn, I don't. I think NASCAR is adamant. They have polled. There's lots. They polled. Obviously, none of us know what's going to happen the next few months. We all hope that there are people in NASCAR who believe that they'll be back to racing in early May, and that IndyCar in late May. NASCAR has already said they want to run all these races, and they may run some on Wednesday night. Now, will they abbreviate some of these in terms of making them shorter races? Yeah, and you know what? They might find out that a shorter race run on prime time in the middle of the week may get pretty good ratings because people will sit there and watch it for 2.5-3 hours versus 4 hours or more on a Sunday. They may end up finding something they never really were looking for, and that's viewership again and some of those things. So it may end up being a win-win for them. But I think that they're going to try to run as many as they can, and for several reasons. Running a race, the drivers, the owners, and the track promoters all have sponsorship contracts for people who are going to buy that race and sponsor that race and pay those bills so they can pay those drivers and pay those crew members. And if they don't run a race, even though the length may be adjusted a little bit, that goes away. And right now I'm told there are sponsors who are withholding payments to some teams, which is making some of these owners have to furlough some crew members, at least temporarily, because they aren't racing. So I think it behooves all of them, if we can do it safely. Obviously, we're dealing with a medical crisis, number one. That's first and foremost. Number two, there's the financial crisis associated with the shutdown with that. And so we can get past the medical crisis. Hopefully we will. Then I think NASCAR and IndyCar will do their darndest to try to get that schedule and run as many as possible. Will it be a full 10-race championship? I don't know. It depends on how much time they have. But you've already seen where IndyCar has moved the Indy 500 to August. And that had to be done because there's so many components of that race in the month of May that come from Europe, and that would not be a possibility, even optimistically right now, not be a possibility to have open travel by the middle of May between the countries in Europe and Asia to Indianapolis.
Hey, Lynn, we appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Hope you and yours stay safe. We'll get a break. When we return, a quick news update from our friend Bob Yarbrough with our sister station, News Talk 98.7. And then a final segment with Doc Punch. If you have a question or comment for Doc, 656-9900, 656-9900. That's how you join 99.1, the sports animal.
Only one radio station makes your workday a little more manageable. Only one station is 99.1. The Sports Animal.
We've got more time coming up with Dr. Jerry Punch, but right now we want to get a news update as we check in with Bob Yarbrough from our sister station, News Talk 98.7. Bob, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, John. There are a few things that have happened within the past few minutes regarding the COVID-19 situation, and as we're going to do each weekday for the next little bit, we'll give you updates here on the Sports Animal as to the latest. And Tennessee Governor Bill Lee just a few moments ago issued a statewide shutdown of all non-essential businesses. Again, this is statewide. He says this will protect the economy while protecting Tennesseans. These are things like barbershops, beauty salons who can't safely operate. As you well know, about a week ago, the Knox County Health Department issued something very similar here in Knox County, and there have been a lot of cities and a lot of counties across the state that have issued similar safer-at-home orders. But again, this is from Tennessee Governor Bill Lee. Just a few moments ago, he's issued a statewide shutdown of all non-essential businesses in the wake of the COVID-19 situation. This for the next 2 weeks. Says we'll reevaluate once we get 2 weeks into this and see where we stand then, and if there needs to be extended, he'll do that. As far as the total numbers of COVID-19 cases in Tennessee, statewide numbers, 1,834. That's up from 1,537 cases on Sunday. In Knox County, we're looking now at 57 confirmed cases. That's up from 41 on Sunday. 17 people in Knox County have been released from isolation after testing positive. So 17 people have recovered here in Knox County. And the mayor of Knox County, Glenn Jacobs, this afternoon is going to shut down all playgrounds and bathrooms owned and operated by the county. Again, that coming up at the end of the day. The mayor says he's responding to the president's directive to continue social distancing protocol until at least April the 30th.
For more information, go where?
Absolutely. Newstalk987.com. We've got a county-by-county breakdown of all the COVID-19 positive cases that have been listed there and the statewide numbers as well. Again, that's Newstalk987.com.
Bob, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch, his appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville. Get a question or comment in under the wire for Doc, 656-9900, 656-9900. Let's check in with Randy. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Randy.
Hello. Good afternoon, John, Jimmy, and Dr. Punch. How's everybody doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Well, I tell you what, this coronavirus thing's getting out of hand. I think Dr. Punch needs to be our Surgeon General to get this straightened out, or the Health and Human Services Secretary. I'm not joking when I say that. I think Dr. Punch has got the knowledge to get this thing on the right track. But, you know, a lot of it, if we build up our immune systems, a lot of it would just be immune to this virus. I mean, I've read that we're vitamin D from sunlight and plenty of exercise, plenty of rest. That builds your immune system up, especially vitamin D from sunlight, not sources like milk or eggs or anything like that. But vitamin D from sunlight and plenty of exercise, plenty of rest, and your immune system can knock this thing off. And I think it's just, you know, it's just getting out of hand. If people would just start living a little more healthy lifestyle, I don't think you'll have near as many cases.
Well, I mean, of course,
and quick hit on that.
And Randy, we sure do appreciate that. I think he would be saying, Doc, for the healthy the folks in the crowd, because I think one thing that we've seen, if you have any kind of underlying condition, especially those that are compromised in terms of their immune system, then you've got underlying effects that can quickly make this not just serious, but also critical.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be life-threatening. I think we appreciate the call, Randy. I think that the good news is we need to do exactly what, the President Trump and Governor Lee is saying. We need to do our part, and the social distancing, staying in. Fortunately, 1,800 cases in the state of Tennessee is not a lot, but it's still more than we want. And we're among the more fortunate states in terms of the number of cases. But if we can eliminate or minimize spread and get beyond the next 2 weeks, there are a lot of people who believe that based on numbers from Europe and based on numbers from China and South Korea, that there are people who are speculating the next 2 weeks we will see the peak of this virus in the U.S. And that's not great news, but hopefully for where we are, by shutting down playgrounds as Mayor Jacobs has done and others to provide protection for all ages, hopefully we'll be able to minimize spread and we get beyond this 2 week interval to the end of April, and we're beyond this and behind this. So yeah, you're right. As far as immunocompromised people, they're at risk, but others by and large get this COVID-19. As we've heard, 88% or so will get a bad cold symptoms, flu symptoms, and you will get beyond that in 7 to 10, if not to 14 days.
Let's go to – were you going to say something, Jimmy?
No, go ahead.
Okay, let's go to Jerry. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Jerry.
Hey, hello, guys.
Hey.
I just wanted to mention, I heard, I guess you all talking about Mike Stratton last week. I didn't hear the whole conversation. I assumed that maybe he had passed away, but they didn't pay for today. But I'm sure that you all are not old enough to remember him. You probably wouldn't remember anyway if you weren't a Tennessee fan then. But I remember him vividly because I've used his name over the years many, many times. Anytime somebody was talking about tackling or seeing tacklers, would-be tacklers, bouncing off a ball carriers, trying to tackle with one hand or grab him around the shoulder pad. But in the games I saw, and we didn't see a lot of games back then, I don't know how many, but I still remember that him being, and I've said that over the years, the most vicious tackler that I've ever seen. He would slam ball carriers to the ground, and I don't think he ever apologized for his hits, but he'd get thrown out of a game today. If he played today like he did then, he'd be thrown out in the first quarter because I've said tackling is like rebounding. You really can't teach it. It's just an attitude somebody's got to have that they're going to do. I don't think anybody ever taught Dane Bradshaw how to rebound. But when the ball went up, he just had in his head he was going to do it. He was going to go get it. And tackling's the same way. But anyway, I know you've got out of time here, but did by any chance, I don't think you'd ever have any memory of seeing him play.
Actually, I do. I'm old enough to have seen it, and I remember the tackle he hit on Keith Lincoln. And I enjoyed watching the AFL when I was young. I like the Oilers. I like the several teams. And I remember the Buffalo Bills, and I remember Mike Stratton playing for them. I did not know his background. I was in Louisiana then. I didn't know he was from Tennessee. I knew he was a heck of a football player. But that hit on Lincoln was picturesque, and it's one of the more famous tackles from anybody that played in the AFL.
I didn't see that. I don't remember it. I may have saw it if it was on TV, but I don't remember that. But yeah, I'm surprised you did. I'm glad that you did remember him. But I've thought about mentioning him before when we talk about missed tackle. But he knew how to do it, and he got it done. But I know you're out of time here, so anyway, Glenn, I wanted to get that in there. So I mentioned something about him, but I appreciate you guys. Talk to you again.
All right, Jerry, we sure do appreciate it. Be well.
Doc, I did want to ask you this. Recently, Lincoln Riley was asked, how much work do you need in the fall camp to get your players ready? And he said, about 20 days, that's fine. Well, Brian Kelly of Notre Dame had said the week before he need to start July the 1st. Now, that's quite a bit of difference in terms of trying to prepare college players for the season. What do you think is a reasonable start time for players to get ready for a college football season?
You know, Jimmy, it's interesting. Great question, by the way. I remember going to spring camps, going to fall camps years ago. There was a big difference in philosophies, and that's just what you described. There are some coaches that said we need to get it. He need to hit it hard and be intense starting end of July. And then as years evolved in the recent years, people said, you know, no, we don't need to be doing that. We need to be fresh when the season starts, not worn out from fall camp and like with Tua days and things and have these guys worn down and injuries, et cetera, et cetera. So I would tend to think that my philosophy is probably, you know, especially if you got your offense, unless you've changed coordinators or changed schemes, you could do it. I'm more on the Lincoln Riley kind of scheme. You know, put it in. Normally you play some fairly simple, layup kind of games early, although that's not always the case anymore. But to be able to get your rhythm and your timing down. But I think that the longer you practice, I mean, 1st of July, are you kidding me? You're going to wear people out. You're going to be, the players are going to be worn out, exhausted. Your joints, everything. You're just, you know, before the season even thinks about starting. So that's old school, big time old school. I don't see that. I think the fresher you can be when the season starts, and the better off you're going to be in terms of keeping people healthy.
Doc, what does the week hold for you?
Well, I mean, like everyone else, we're sitting and watching and waiting and hoping we can do our part to be able to stay in and social distance. I think we need to be thankful to our first responders and to our medical personnel at the hospitals, at the UT Medical Center, et cetera, who are on the front lines doing the testing and doing the care and offer to help the elderly and those that cannot get out and do our part there as well in terms of grocery shopping and picking up food, medicine, and prescriptions. And like we all are, I'm sure, we're just hopefully in our prayers with each other, hoping the best for those that are in the hot spots in the Northeast and the Northwest and in California, so that we can get beyond this. I will say this, when Jerry asked that great question a moment ago, unlike Jimmy, I'm not old enough to have seen that guy play, but I certainly wish I would have. It's great to hear from Jerry to talk about a great Tennessean that was a hard hitter in the NFL, but hopefully we'll all have a good weekend, a good week, and we can minimize the spread of this COVID-19, and we can chat about how we're starting to come out of this and starting to get some good news across the nation as early as next week.
All I'm not old. I just have a good memory.
I'm just picking, Jimmy. You're not that much older than me. You know that.
Hey, Doc, sure do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, guys. Take care. Have a good week.
You as well. Stay safe. Be well. And we say thank you to our sponsor of Doc's Hour on a week-to-week basis, and that is our good friends at New Balance Knoxville. We'll get a break and be back. Jimmy, Bill Schmidt will join us next.
Yes, and we look forward to it. I want to hear from Daryl Taylor. He was on The Nation over the weekend.
We've got more coming your way as you listen to Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal. Talk rolls on with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson, and we go to the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline, Jimmy, where a longtime friend and longtime friend of the program joins us now.
Absolutely. That is Bill Schmidt. He's the last American to win a medal in the Olympics in the javelin in 1972. He was also the track and field athlete of the year as selected in the 1980s. Because of his outstanding performance in the javelin, the U.S. javelin throw of the decade, I should say, by Track and Field News, Bill Schmidt. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing great in these times. All's good.
Well, yeah, it's been kind of crazy out there. I did want to ask you, a lot of people were critical of the folks of the IOC for not postponing the Olympics sooner than they did. You were involved with the organization of the L.A. games in 1984. There's a lot that goes into this. Do you think they waited too late, or do you think they were looking at all these different angles and trying to delay it as long as they could before they had to make a decision?
No, I think there was a lot of information that they had to take into consideration, and as well as the medical experts, which, you know, they have access to as well. But I think they waited as long as they could. I think currently, you know, there's some speculation out there that they waited too long by some of the athletes. And now there's a campaign, I don't know whether you saw it or not, they're selling T-shirts, everything else, donations, et cetera, that say, thank you, Japan, and with the script underneath that in Japanese. So I think there's a move that mostly everyone that I've talked to agrees that it was the right thing to do. And we had not a similar instance, but, you know, I got caught up in the whole boycott. I didn't boycott, but it was a boycott. And the same thing happened in L.A. when I was vice president of sports there. We had 18 countries that we thought were coming that didn't, and they were from the Eastern Bloc countries at the time. And it had an effect on what our planning was and how we dealt with that. And Peter Huberoth had some interesting ways to get athletes to the L.A. Games. A quick story, he literally at the African countries championships, it's all the countries from Africa, after they completed their championships, he had a 747 there to pick the teams up and bring them to L.A. So he literally tried to bolster the number of countries that were competing in L.A., and that was one of the ways he did it. So pretty innovative on his part.
There were another number of athletes that were upset about the boycott because they were participating. We talked to Holly Warlick about that because she was on the women's Olympic team. What was your situation at that time? You had won a medal in 1972, but in 1980, what was your situation, Bill?
Well, I came off of winning the national title in 1978, so I was one of the favorites to make the team. And I was on the board of the directors of USA Track and Field at the time, so, you know, while they had board meetings, I was always involved. I'm kind of the athlete's rep. So, you know, after the Winter Games of, you know, 1980 and the success of the hockey team, everybody basked in the sun of that. And all of a sudden, you know, a couple of weeks later, we're starting to get wind of the fact that we may not be going to Moscow. And then a week or two after that, we had a board meeting and they said, well, it's been decided. We're not going. Now we have to plan on what we're going to do next. Are we going to pick a team or what? So they decided to pick a team. And at the time, I was working they had an Olympic job opportunity program where you had a sponsor, per se, that you could work at, and you get time off for your track. And so you had a salary, as you know, for the job. And I was working for the Hyatt Corporation and working out of the Hyatt here in downtown Knoxville. So when I got the word, I'm going, you know, my dream at that point was gone. My goal was to make it back to the Olympics. It wasn't to make the Olympic team. You know, and you start planning this from a standpoint of scheduling meets, et cetera, over a year out. And, you know, so I basically, there was no incentive for me. I could have quit. I could quit my job. And I thought, well, I better make it to some meets. And I basically went through the motions, quite honestly. And if I had to do over again, I probably would have done the same thing. But my heart and soul wasn't in it. I knew it wasn't for what my goal was, what I was working on. Every sit-up, every lift, it was by going to Moscow and winning there. So,
were you angered by the reasoning for the boycott, or did you understand?
No, I was angered by it. Again, as an athlete, you're training. It's a four-year cycle. And again, there's an Olympic historian put out, Bill Mallon put out some figures. Only 27% of the athletes from the four-year previous Olympics make it to the next games. There was only one time when they broke away from the template of having winter and summer games the same year. And then in 1992, they changed it to 92 and 94 and then went four years after that. And 42% of the individuals from 2 years out only made the team. So there's no guarantee. I wouldn't have it any other way. There's been a variety of selection process, and I just take the best on that day when you make it. You know, in 76, maybe I wouldn't have agreed to that. I had the fourth longest throw in the world, didn't make the team. So, but I knew what the results were going to be. You had to make it that day or you didn't go. So, no, I didn't understand, the politics of it. I can understand the fact that, I knew that everything would go on as normal, even though, you know, the Russians had, the irony was the Russians invaded Afghanistan and we were there, and Carter decided we weren't going to go. And I think most, as I think back, most of the public thought we shouldn't go, but I think most of the athletes today feel bitter about it. Boycotts are one thing, but this coronavirus is another thing altogether. There's nothing political about it. It's a medical issue, and Tuca did the right thing.
Bill, it's great to talk to you again, and that's exactly where I was going with my question. Could you imagine sitting in the organizer's seat knowing that while you are still months away from when you hope to have your opening ceremonies in Tokyo, that you also know that we're right at the point where people would be capping their training for their respective national trials to make the Olympic team? Could you imagine trying to make the call that they had to make when there have been so few answers to all the questions that are out there, and one being exactly whether or not this would still be on the landscape as big and prominent in the summer as it is right now?
Yeah, good point, John. They're literally the Olympic trials, I mean, I think this next week, only because my twin brother was a wrestler in college, would I know this. The Olympic wrestling trials are this week, weekend, normally, but they're not scheduled. You've got swimming and diving and track and field and gymnastics were scheduled all the way through April through June. And there's no question that they knew what the result might have been. But with the current makeup of the International Olympic Committee, out of the 15 individuals on the board, six of them were Olympic athletes, and three of them participated internationally. So out of the 15 members, there were nine that knew what the athletes' mindset was. So I think that probably called into question as to why they waited as long as they could and should. At the same time, you have the Tokyo Olympic Organizing Committee. They've got a budget of $12.6 billion, and to go ahead and postpone that for another year, the clock keeps running, and so does the check keep rising. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to go ahead and pay for those facilities if they're already booked. Most of the world championships, I would venture to say, are going to be moved from 2021 to the following year. So that calendar will change. And they'll do everything they can. They pretty much have come out and said it'll be the same dates, you know, July 24th through August 7th of 2021. And I also heard that they're also going to call it the Olympics of 2020 in 2021. So,
Bill, when you take a look at the grandfathering, anybody who qualified for their Olympic team this year will also be automatically furthered onto the roster next year. How difficult or how different can you imagine what this calendar year will be like for those that might get another chance to make the team compared to those that do have a spot?
Well, I think they did the right thing by those who have all already qualified. And I think it's close to 50%, John. And at the same time, I mean, I wasn't favored to make the Olympic team, the U.S. team in 1971. I made it in 72, and I surely wasn't favored to medal, let alone in the top 10 or 12. But in some cases, it's the best chance this year for athletes, and sometimes the last chance they have. So to put that on hold, you know, it's out of your control. Mm-hmm. And, you try to go ahead and do what you can, control what you can, and everything else outside of your control. I mean, consider the fact that these athletes aren't training. I mean, maybe out running or doing something, but there's no meets or events to get them to peak in a certain period of time. That's gone away. So, and then after a couple countries decided that they weren't going to send athletes, you know, Canada and Australia and a few other European countries, I think the International Olympic Committee saw the writing on the wall and knew they had to act and did their due diligence. And from a standpoint of what would it be for a year, and then I'm sure they're going to provide some relief to the Tokyo Olympic Organizing Committee as well as the other national Olympic organizing groups, because you know they have to go ahead and get refunds or whatever from their bookings, their pre-games, training campuses, and hospitality arrangements, and those aren't with the organizing committee. Those are with private individuals and corporations.
Our guest, Bill Schmidt. We'll get a break. We've got more with Bill coming up as you listen to Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting.
Here's to swimming with bow-legged women.
This is Sports Radio WNML.
final segment to hour number two of Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams. Our guest, Bill Schmidt, as he joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline.
Bill, I want to ask you about Justin Gatlin. I think he's about 38 years old. He's already defied Father Time as a sprinter. And I wonder if you think one more year could have a negative impact on his ability to medal in the Olympics next year.
I would guess so. As they say, Father Time is undefeated. literally, I won my national title. I was 31, which is unusual because you normally don't stay in the sport that long. And particularly in the sprinting world, you know, these guys come on quick and no pun intended, they're out in the blaze. He has been defying time for so long. I don't know how he's going to keep it going, but nothing would surprise me. I mean, he could still do it. But there'll still be some youngster that comes along that wasn't picked and didn't have enough training to make the 2020 team. But one more year later, who knows? They're right there, competing for the medal. So it'd be interesting to see it. And like I said, it's difficult to make the assumption that 31 or 32, wherever he's going to be, it could happen.
I want to ask you about Phil Olson. He is a former All-American at the University of Tennessee. He was a four-time All-American. He was an NCAA champion. He passed away recently from Canada. He was also selected in 1994 by a panel, the greatest javelin thrower in Canada history. And I know that you had a part in him coming to Tennessee. Tell us your story and your relationship with Phil Olson.
Well, I competed with we had club sponsorships and whatnot, and there was a group of us that were Olympic athletes and medal winners that competed under the banner of the Pacific Coast Club, and we had a manager, and sometimes we skipped the national championships because back in those days you weren't supposed to make money, but we could make money with this group, and you kind of took the money under the table. Now they get they get endorsements, they get prize money, appearance money, and everything else. So it was one of those years where I didn't compete in the national championship, and I made the circuit, so to speak, and I was competing in Athens, Greece. And it was a twilight meet, still pretty warm, and I'm down there throwing. And, you don't assess the competition, but I threw, I think, close to 270 or something like that, which I was pretty averaging that. And this guy who looks pretty good and pretty big, well-toned, finished second, and he threw about 256, which is a pretty darn good throw. And I walked over to him, and I said, "Yeah, I want to congratulate you." And he said, thank you. And I said, "Well, where are you from?" He said, "Well, I'm competing for Canada. I'm a junior." And I said, "Well, what college are you going to?" He said, "No, I'm a junior in high school." And I about lost my jaw dropped. I mean, I threw 204 in high school, to do a comparison. My senior year, his kid's throwing 256 and close to the Canadian national record as his junior year. And I started talking to him, and then when I get back, I was a GA for track and field with Stan Huntsman, and I said, "Stan, I got the next NCAA champion in the javelin." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "This kid right here. No question about it." I said, "But I need to go to Nanaimo, British Columbia." And I wasn't sure he was going to bite on that. Travel budgets weren't that. I was in charge of recruiting, but still, he wasn't going to pay for a ticket for me to go to Vancouver. And he said, "Well, maybe you can get him in here." I said, "Well, I don't think so." But over the course of time, Phil graduated early, much like the football players entered the spring here for spring ball. He entered in the spring, never made a trip to UT. And they said, as they say, the rest is history. The kid's just, a heck of an athlete, heck of a talent, heck of an arm, rocket ability, and a lot of speed and a lot of whip. And in fact, in his home country in the 76 Olympics, he was probably in the top five in the qualifying round and set a new personal record and a new Canadian record. And it goes to the next day. Well, all those marks don't count. And I think he finished 11th, but he made a great showing and everyone picked him from Canada. He virtually didn't have any. I mean, he dominated the competition up there, and he dominated here in the U.S. for quite a while. But I was saddened to see that as well, and I had to check on his records to see what he did, because I thought he would have won more than one NCAA title, but he didn't. He won the SEC for 4 years, and I don't know whether he had injuries. We lost track. I had to go on with my career and a job and left UT, and so But an incredible, incredible athlete, and what natural ability he had. There wasn't anything he couldn't do, literally.
Well, he could apparently throw a football. I read where he threw one 100 yards. Do you think he really did that?
I don't think there's any question he could. Absolutely. If you're a javelin thrower, number one, you've got a pretty good arm. And you throw a football, you don't throw it like a football, you throw it like a javelin. In fact, Bradshaw held the national record for a long time at a gentleman who was a tight end for the Patriots, Francis, threw it 262 in high school. Mm-hmm. He had the national record. Of course, they've changed that. So quarterbacks threw it quite, because they had good arms. And now it doesn't surprise me. I believe every bit of it. I saw that in his obituary as well when I checked his local paper there in Nanaimo. So that doesn't surprise me at all. They could have listed a number of other things as far as what he did. And that wouldn't have surprised me either from an athletic ability standpoint. He was exceptional.
Hey, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really do appreciate it. Always good to catch up with you, and you be safe, okay?
You be safe as well, and when it does open up on the links, Jimmy, let's tee it up.
I'd love to do it. Thank you very much, Bill.
All right. Hey, take care.
That's Olympian Bill Smith, the last American to medal in the javelin. He did so in 1972.
That's Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. That does it for hour number two of Sports Talk. Coming up, hour number three. It starts with our good friend Rob Lewis of AllQuest.com. That's next on 99.1, The Sports Animal.